And now it's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. Uncle Dennis here at Free Radio Santa Cruz on Thursday, May 26th. I'd like to ask you to have a pencil and paper handy to record names, addresses, telephone numbers, web pages, any information that you're going to need in order to take action. Let's start off with announcements. The California Department of Fish and Wildlife plans public meetings on water use and native fishery impacts in South Bay coastal counties. The California Department of Fish and Wildlife, in collaboration with the Santa Cruz and San Mateo Resource Conservation Districts and the State Water Resources Control Board, will hold two public meetings to address how residents can contribute to water conservation efforts that will help to save native fisheries. The streams in this area are home to the last remaining coho salmon populations south of the Golden Gate Bridge. The meetings will be held on Wednesday, June 1st, from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the Resource Center for Nonviolence, 612 Ocean Street in Santa Cruz. Once again, that's Wednesday, June 1st, 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the Resource Center for Nonviolence, 612 Ocean Street in Santa Cruz. On Thursday, June 2nd, also from 6:30 to 8 p.m., the meeting will be held at the Pescadero Native Sons Community Hall, 112 Stage Road in Pescadero. Once again, that meeting is June 2nd from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the Pescadero Native Sons Community Hall, 112 Stage Road in Pescadero. The watersheds of Santa Cruz and San Mateo counties constitute the southern end of the natural range of coho salmon in California. Ongoing drought conditions were not significantly affected by this winter's rains, and coho and steelhead trout in this region continue to face severe obstacles to population recovery. Wild coho salmon are drastically depleted from San Gregorio and Pescadero Creeks in coastal San Mateo County to the San Lorenzo River and Soquel and Aptos Creeks in Santa Cruz County. Reduced stream flows have resulted in a series of disconnected pools trapping juvenile fish and exposing them to increasing threats. The meetings will provide an opportunity to discuss the reliability of local water supply and offer information to residents who are not on municipal water. Landowners in coastal watersheds that depend on water from wells and stream diversions will learn what they can do to reduce their impacts on threatened and endangered native fish species, as well as to comply with state water use and reporting requirements. Grant funding opportunities may be available for water conservation and water storage projects, which will be reviewed at these public meetings. Water conservation in these critical watersheds needs to be a daily commitment, said Eric Larson, Environmental Program Manager with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. The information provided at these meetings will illustrate water conservation methods that have been effective in similar settings. Once again, Wednesday, June 1st from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the Resource Center for Nonviolence, 612 Ocean Street in Santa Cruz, and Thursday, June 2nd from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the Pescadero Native Sons Community Hall, 112 Stage Road in Pescadero. For information, go to www.wildlife.ca.gov. And the Earth First Northwest Rendezvous is right around the corner from this story from the Earth First Newswire. Cascadia Forest Defenders and the League of Extraordinary Cascadians are pleased to announce the Earth First Northwest Rendezvous from June 10th to the 13th in the heart of the Southern Cascades. Get ready for a very long, hot summer of action on our traditional socializing working fest, unwinding in the old forest with old friends, meeting new friends and allies, sharing meals and skills and crazy ideas, and maybe a soft drink or a cup of ale. Take a plant hike, dip in the river, climb an ancient dug or buffalo rock, or troop out up to one of the native threatened forests. We've got an incredible old-growth site that runs for over a mile along a lovely, if potentially lethal, river. Delicious water, a certain amount of medical resources, noon circles, and fabulous company that's guaranteed to increase your chances of federal surveillance and higher standing with your grandchildren, grandnephews, and nieces, etc. And they're pretty good hands with wildlife survival, plants, navigation, tree climbing, direct action strategy and tactics, ecology, regional history, and many other things which you might be interested in. Expect some formalized workshops. Maybe plan on sharing what you know. You bring your sustainable self, which should include food, a means to prepare it, and there will be no centralized community kitchen. This is old school. Camping gear, bug repellent, rain gear, decent closed-toed shoes, a headlamp, a cup, plate and or bowl, fork and or spoon, party clothes, and biocentric point of view, capacity to disregard the rule of law or accept and support that disregard in others, tolerance and a sense of humor. Musical or similar talents are revered and appreciated. Please don't bring your dogs. Leg hold traps have been found in the area, and wildlife could use one less hassle in the landscape. Leave that abusive attitude at home. Don't have any secret microphones or any idea your workshop needs to be mandatory. So you want to get up in the old growth, try to haul a roadless area timber sale, or get acquainted with the kayak mob and the oil blockaders? Come out to the woods and check us out. Stick around on Monday for a kick-ass action or actions. Heck, why not just make a summer of it? Directions. The site is on the bank of the North Fork of the Middle Fork of the Willamette River, 20-some miles north of the human settlements of West Fur in Oak Ridge, Oregon. Most seeking the VU will travel north or south on State 5, as the case may be. Turn east on Highway 58, just south of Eugene, at the Middle Fork Ranger Station, milepost 31 or so. The traveler will turn left at the sign for West Fur, cross a green trestle bridge over the Middle Fork, and make a left at the stop sign. A few miles along this road, the traveler will encounter a four-way stop and a red-covered bridge on the left-hand side of the road. Proceed straight. The road changes its name to Forest Service Road 19, also referred to as the Offerhide Loop. Traveling north through the ancient forest and thin second growth along the beautiful and risky North Fork for 20.7 miles, there are mile markers on Forest Service Road 19. Just after crossing our river, put it on the south side of the road. The attentive rendezvouser will turn left up Forest Service Road 1939 and follow that back west. They'll follow this road, ignoring the right fork, about a half mile up, and we'll find a trailhead marker and a trail about 1.5 mile up from Road 19. We'll call this the front gate, and with a little parking there, gear should be unloaded and the vehicle move farther up the road to be parked, as per the directions you'll get from the front gate crew. Those travelers determined to approach from the east will have to hit Highway 58 off I-97 between Chemult and Lapine, drive through Oak Ridge, make the turn on West Fur, and then proceed as described. There is no cell phone reception at the site. For information, check out the Cascadia Forest Defenders at forestdefensenow.com. And you can find this and more information at the Earth First Journal Newswire, earthfirstjournal.org/newswire. And, of course, the Earth First Round River Rendezvous is going to be taking place at the Great Lakes Basin this summer. There's a whole lot of information to be found at the Earth First Newswire site. Check it out there. And if you need for information, go to send email to RRR2016 at riseup.net. That's RRR2016 at riseup.net. And for more information, check out the Earth First Journal Newswire page. Here in Santa Cruz Biotech has agreed to close their abusive laboratory and relinquish their animal dealer license in this story from Santa Cruz Indie Bay, as found on Earth First Newswire. Santa Cruz Biotech has been fined $3.5 million and agrees to give up its animal dealer license and close its research laboratory, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which oversees research facilities. The penalty is the largest in history of Animal Welfare Act enforcement, said Stop Animal Exploitation Now, a nonprofit research watchdog that monitors illegal activities in the U.S. research laboratories. Stop Animal Exploitation Now first exposed the violations of federal law at Santa Cruz Biotech with news coverage in 2008 and has filed multiple complaints with the U.S. Department of Agriculture against Santa Cruz Biotech. According to a U.S. Department of Agriculture email, on May 19, 2016, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service and Santa Cruz Biotechnology Incorporated entered into a settlement agreement, otherwise known as a consent decision, that provides that Santa Cruz Biotechnology, Inc. is not admitting or denying it has violated the Animal Welfare Act and contains an order that includes a provision to cease and desist from violating that act, assessment of a $3.5 million civil penalty, revocation of its dealer's license effective December 31, 2016, and agreement to submit a letter to cancel its research registration by May 31, 2016. The USDA communication goes on to say, APHIS filed complaints against Santa Cruz Biotechnology on July 19, 2012, November 4, 2014, and August 7, 2015 for allegedly failing to maintain the basic standards of the Animal Welfare Act on multiple occasions. This precedent-setting decision by the U.S. Department of Agriculture is not only the largest penalty ever issued, but with the closure of Santa Cruz Biotech Labs and their dealer facility as well, the abuse of thousands of animals has now ended forever, said Michael Budke, AHT, co-founder of Stop Animal Exploitation Now. We cannot adequately applaud the actions of the United States Department of Agriculture. And that news was from the earthfirstjournal.org/newswire. Here is the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for this week. Another hazing operation, the second of the year, took place yesterday. More than 50 buffalo with at least 20 calves were chased from habitat on the south side of the Madison River by three Montana Department of Livestock agents. The agents have been itching to haze buffalo, and yesterday they got their thrill, though it is questionable if these unjustified actions were legal. The governor's year-round habitat decision contains contradictory language and maps, and it seems the different agencies are interpreting it differently. According to the Buffalo Field Campaign's recent discussions with Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, lands south of the Madison River and east of the South Fork are part of the buffalo's year-round habitat. Instead of the language, the Montana Department of Livestock is going by the map, which shows less habitat. These agencies, who are supposed to be working together, are clearly not on the same page, and the Montana Department of Livestock has taken advantage of the confusion. After being chased through a forest heavily covered with fallen trees, the buffalo were forced to swim across the Madison River. Exhausted after such abuse, the buffalo quickly bedded down, grazed, and began nursing as soon as the Montana Department of Livestock quit harassing them. Buffalo in other portions of the Hebgen Basin are enjoying themselves, roaming around as they please, and many others have already migrated back into Yellowstone on their own. The majority of people who live on Horse Butte's Yellowstone Village are having some of their dreams come true, waking up in the company of wild buffalo who are under no threat from government agents. It is still taking us some time for this monumental achievement to sink in, but we are celebrating. Most of the baby buffalo in the Hebgen Basin have never experienced being hazed, and hopefully they never will. Obviously, there are still threats on land south of the Madison River, and we're pressing the agencies to get on the same page. We will continue to do what it takes to erase all of the lines in the sand until wild buffalo roam wherever they want to. Spend your summer in Yellowstone with the Buffalo Field Campaign. Volunteers are wanted. Buffalo Field Campaign is seeking volunteers who have an earnest desire to help our national mammal, the buffalo, run wild and free. We are seeking people comfortable with talking to Yellowstone visitors to help run our summer outreach programs. This is the 100-year anniversary of the National Park Service, and Yellowstone is expecting millions of visitors. This is a great opportunity to help educate and inspire people. Volunteers get to spend 5 days a week camping in beautiful Yellowstone National Park. You'll spend your days enjoying all of that landscape has to offer, from relaxing in the boiling river to watching a mama black bear and her cubs. You'll have the amazing opportunity of seeing buffalo during the rut while helping to do outreach on their behalf. Educating park visitors on the plight of America's last wild bison is one of the most important parts of what we do here at the Buffalo Field Campaign. While tabling, you'll meet people from all over the world and bring the buffalo's story to them. During the 5 days in the park, volunteers will share a tent at various campgrounds in and around Yellowstone. When volunteers are not tabling, adventuring in the park is one of the many benefits of summers in Yellowstone, with plenty of places to hike, swim, and enjoy nature. There are also 2 days a week when volunteers will be back at our main cabin to relax. If this sounds exciting to you, please contact us. And the Buffalo Field Campaign can receive donations at P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. Their webpage is www.buffalofieldcampaign.org, which has more information about volunteering and all this contact information or more. And if you have any questions, give them a call at 406-646-0070. That's 406-646-0070. Please remember the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And a rancher has killed the first wolverine in seen in North Dakota in 150 years in this story from the Earth First Newswire. The wolverine was known by conservationists as M56. Jared Hatter shot, killed, and then posed with a rare animal so he could brag about it on social media. Until this killing, a wolverine sighting hadn't even been confirmed in North Dakota since the 1800s. Jared claims the wolverine was harassing cattle, thus justifying the murder in the eyes of the state. Before his premature and needless death, M56 was known around the country for his over 500-mile journey from Wyoming to Colorado in 2009, which was tracked through his radio collar by wildlife authorities. His collar stopped transmitting in 2012, and 4 years later he was killed by Jared around 700 miles from his last known location. American wolverines are critically endangered in the United States, but unfortunately do not have Endangered Species Act protection. The Center of Biological Diversity says, unfortunately, in the contiguous United States, this tough scavenger predator is barely holding on. Trapping and habitat loss have been dramatically shrinking its population for more than a century, and now it's faced with new human threats like snowmobiles tearing through its habitat, and worse, global warming threatening the deep snow it relies on for life activities from traveling to denning and raising kits. Yet the federal government has repeatedly refused to protect the wolverine, first denying proof of its peril in the lower 48 states and then declaring that while the animal may be imperiled here, it doesn't need to be listed under the Endangered Species Act because wolverine populations in Canada are still stable. Like many other species, from the Cactus ferruginous pygmy owl to the Mexican garter snake, and the American wolverine has been denied the protection it needs simply because its peers across the border are more widespread. And you can find more news about wolverines at theearthfirstjournal.org/newswire. And three illegal fishing trawlers have been arrested following a night raid by Sea Shepherd and Gabonese authorities. In this story from the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. The crew of the Sea Shepherd ship, Bob Barker, has assisted Gabonese authorities in the arrest of three illegal fishing trawlers in the coastal waters off Gabon, Central West Africa. The arrest followed a three-day coordinated effort between the Marine National, that is the Gabonese Navy, and ANPA, the Fisheries Enforcement Agency, and Sea Shepherd that culminated in a successful night raid on the illegal vessels in the early hours of Sunday morning. At the time they were intercepted, the three Congo flag trawlers were actively engaged in illegal fishing inside Gabon's territorial waters and exclusive economic zone after crossing the border from the Republic of Congo. One of the vessels was also inside the Mayamba National Park limits, a marine protected area on the border of Gabon and Congo, 6 nautical miles off the Gabonese coast. Boarding parties consisting of armed Gabonese Marines and ANPA fisheries observers boarded and secured the illegal trawlers without injury or incident. Bob Barker, ship manager, and second officer Lex Rigby reports, "Under the cover of darkness, we launched 2 small boats with armed boarding teams from the Gabonese Navy and Fisheries Enforcement Agency, assisted by the Marine National's riverine patrol boat, the MV Mayumba. While Gabonese officials boarded the first fishing vessel and gained control, the Sea Shepherd crew remained alongside, lighting up the fishing vessel's decks and documenting its activities. Boarding teams then secured the second and third illegal vessels, one of which was running at 8 knots at the time it was boarded. All 3 vessels have been handed over to local authorities in the port of Mayumba to commence further investigation and the necessary legal proceedings. The 3 illegal fishing trawlers, with crews of several nationalities, including Chinese and Congolese nationals, are the first arrests undertaken as part of Operation Albacore, a joint campaign between the Sea Shepherd and government of Gabon. Launched in April, Operation Albacore will tackle illegal, unregulated, and unreported fishing under the direction of the government of Gabon Throughout the 2016 tuna fishing season, Marine Nationale and officers with ANPO will be stationed on board the Bob Barker, working alongside Sea Shepherd's crews to patrol Gabonese sovereign waters. The patrols will provide a vehicle for law enforcement to defend, conserve, and protect critical tuna habitat in the region through September of 2016. Sea Shepherd Operation Albacore campaign leader Captain Peter Hammerstedt said, "The hugely successful commencement of the campaign demonstrates the strength of the cooperative effort between the Gabonese state authorities and Sea Shepherd. We are immensely proud of this collaboration, which has resulted in this victory for conservation law and for the oceans." And for more information, go to www.seashepherd.org.au. And a study shows that trees are moving to higher, cooler elevations. Signature tree species in the High Sierra Nevada forests, including mountain hemlock, red fir, and western white pine, are shifting toward higher, cooler elevations, according to new research by the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. This study foreshadows how climate warming may significantly alter entire habitats for multiple species. The CDFW researchers found that large areas of Plumas and Sierra counties no longer have much mountain hemlock, as much as the northern Sierra Nevada lacks the higher mountains that trees now need to persist. These conifer species are shifting to higher elevations to provide food for insects, birds, and mammals, and help build forest soil. This report was published in the California Fish and Game Winter Issue. In addition to research on high elevation tree species in northern Sierra Nevada, CDFW-funded researchers also recently concluded that 16 of 29 different types of natural vegetation communities in California are highly or near highly vulnerable to climate change by the end of the century. These include Pacific Coast salt marsh, high montane conifer forest, and western North American freshwater marsh. The climate vulnerability study was completed by researchers at UC Davis with funding from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, called A Climate Change Vulnerability Assessment of California's Terrestrial Vegetation. The report can be found by visiting the CDFW website. It was prepared in association with CDFW's State Wildlife Action Plan 2015 update, and the research will help the department understand why certain ecosystems are more vulnerable to climate change and where species may be able to persist during unfavorable environmental conditions. For more information, go to www.wildlife.ca.gov. And turning to biodiversity news, 125 Hawaiian species have gotten 157,000 acres of protected habitat. With more endangered species than any other state, Hawaii is still on the front lines of the extinction crisis. But the good news is the Fish and Wildlife Service has protected 157,000 acres of critical habitat for 125 species of plants and animals on the islands of Molokai, Maui, and Kahului. Many of these species gained protection as a result of a settlement with the Center for Biological Diversity, which has long advocated for protecting the habitats. The species range from plants to tree snails and striking forest birds. Invasive species habitat loss and the effects of introduced pigs, goats, and deer are the primary threats to their survival. Critical habitat will speed restoration efforts for many of these imperiled species, so I'm glad to see that will happen, said Loyal Meyerhoff, the Center's Endangered Species Recovery Director. And the court has slammed the federal government for allowing grizzly killings. An important win for grizzlies, thanks to a lawsuit by the Center for Biological Diversity and their allies, a judge has commanded the Fish and Wildlife Service to stop turning a blind eye to hunters killing grizzly bears in the Yellowstone region. Grizzly bears in and around Yellowstone National Park are federally protected and still vulnerable to a myriad of threats, including low genetic diversity caused by their isolation and small population. Nevertheless, the service in 2013 approved the shooting of up to 4 bears in Grand Teton National Park during the park's annual elk hunt. In estimating this decision's potential impacts, the feds didn't properly consider many previous approvals of grizzly killings across the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, which allowed up to 63 grizzly bears to die. We sued, and we won. Last week, the federal court ruled the service's 2013 action illegal under the Endangered Species Act, said the center's Andrea Santarcier, who worked on this case. Grand Teton should now be a safe haven for grizzly bears, not a killing zone. And the fatal bat disease, white nose syndrome, has hit the West. White nose syndrome, which has already killed 7 million bats in the east, has now reached the U.S. west, leapfrogging 1,300 miles to do so. Wildlife officials have confirmed that a dead bat in Washington state was infected with the dangerous disease. The discovery marks the first time the illness, first found in North America 10 years ago in upstate New York, has been documented in the west. The fungus that causes it was most recently discovered in eastern Nebraska. White nose syndrome has resulted in dramatic declines in several bat species, including the northern long-eared bat, little brown bat, and Indiana bat. Since the disease does jump more than 1,000 miles, it seems very likely that humans are helping to spread it. The Center for Biological Diversity has been calling on federal officials to do more to stem the march of the disease. This is a wake-up call for land managers in the West to do what's needed to keep white nose syndrome from spinning out of control before it's too late, said the center's Molly Madison. And a study states the West Antarctic ice sheet could melt faster than predicted. A dire new climate study suggests that the West Antarctic ice sheet, larger than Mexico and capable of raising global sea levels by at least 12 feet, may break up far sooner than previously thought. If greenhouse gases continued to be emitted as quickly as they are today, the ice sheet could disintegrate over decades rather than centuries, raising sea level by as much as 3 feet by the end of this century. The new research is the work of two prominent scientists at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and Pennsylvania State. In addition to other sources of melting ice, sea levels could rise by 5 or 6 feet by century's end, the authors found, about twice what the United Nations predicted as a worst-case scenario just 3 years ago. In the long term, rising oceans will threaten many of the world's greatest cities, including New York, New Orleans, Miami, London, Hong Kong, and Shanghai. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is produced every Thursday evening right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you want to hear a rebroadcast of this Earth First Update, please tune in tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock. And you can also tune in to the Earth First Update at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, Idaho, 90.3 FM, at 3 p.m. on Wednesdays. You can tune in to the Earth First Update on Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC in Boston, Massachusetts on 90.3 FM between 6 and 10 a.m. on Sundays. You can also find the Earth First Update at Grateful Dread Public Radio, an internet radio station, Sundays at 2 a.m. Set your URL to gdprnashville.org. That's gdprnashville.org, and you can also find them on tunein.com and spotify.com. And, of course, you can always go to radioforall.net, that's radio, the number, forall.net, where you can listen online or download this or previous Earth First Updates. The radioforall.net is a community-supported archive for public and community radio station programs. Please support them if you can. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and broadcast. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced at the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening, and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.